I'd like you to take your Bibles and open them to the 30th chapter of Genesis. Beginning at about verse 25, you will find a rather interesting little story tucked in there. It is one of those Horatio Alger or Bill Gates stories, the kind of story where someone began with nothing and went on to great success. We love those stories, especially if the person overcame great odds in the process. When we last looked at the book of Genesis, we were looking at the account of the life of Jacob. And to get us all kind of back in mind to the historical perspective, I'd like you to note this rather brief outline of the book of Genesis. In the first five chapters of Genesis, we have the story of Adam and his immediate family. In the next chapters, 6 through 11, we have the story of Noah and the flood and the events surrounding that and other members of his family. In the next long section of the book of Genesis, chapters 12 through 23, we have the account of the life of Abraham. We learn so much from that man and his relationship with God. In chapters 24 and 26, we have the very short, given to us in short accounts of the life of Isaac, Abraham's son of promise. In chapter 25, we have the account of the birth of Isaac's two sons, Jacob and Esau. We learned that Jacob was apparently a rather self-centered, grasping young man who wound up not only deceiving his father and greatly cheating his older brother, but running for his life. With little but the proverbial clothing on his back, he took refuge on his uncle's cattle ranch many hundreds of miles away. Jacob fell in love with his youngest cousin, Rachel, and he agreed to work for his uncle for 7 years if the uncle would grant to Jacob the marriage of his daughter, Rachel. His uncle cheated him, however. The cheat is cheated. And when it comes time for the wedding, Laban, Jacob's uncle, gives Jacob instead the oldest daughter, Leah. Jacob then agrees to work for 7 more years to have the right to marry the younger daughter, Rachel. Apparently, the marriage actually took place immediately, even though he was to work for 7 more years, because during those next 7 years, with those two wives and their servant girls, those four women, Jacob had 11 sons and one daughter. Now, the situation that marks the beginning of our story for today, Genesis chapter 30, about verse 25, is that while Jacob had two wives and these 12 young kids, he had no other resources. He had worked for his uncle for 14 years, and other than room and board, he had nothing to show for his labor. He had tremendous responsibility, this large family. But 14 years later, he is still a poor man, no assets with which to care for that family. At that point, he goes to his uncle, whose name was Laban, and he tells him that he wants to take his family and return to his homeland, the family that he had paid for with 14 years of his labor. Old Laban, ever the conniving uncle, begs Jacob to stay and promises him that this time, in contrast to the preceding 14 years, this time he would pay him. Jacob reminds Laban how that Laban's prosperity has been because of God's blessing through Jacob. But, Jacob adds, I have to do something for my own family. Laban then says, what do you want me to give you? Jacob said, I don't want you to give me anything. I just want to make a deal with you so that over the next few years I can actually make a profit around here. Now, to understand the deal that they made, you have to have some understanding of what they understood about animal husbandry and genetics. Laban was a sheep and goat rancher, and Jacob was the chief shepherd for Laban. Now, the chief shepherd did not just sit around on the hillside making whistling sounds through blades of grass while the cattle pastured nearby. The chief shepherd was responsible for other things, responsible for making certain that the sheep and goats got the right diet, responsible that they were kept safe, and responsible for breeding them in such a way that the strongest and healthiest sheep and most valuable sheep and goats would be reproduced. Now, I am told in my reading that it's still true today, as it was then, that by far the most valuable and numerous sheep were white in color, and by far the most valuable and numerous goats were black in color. And most of you have taken just enough biology to know something about genetics, and you know that if the white sheep mate, they will most likely produce white lambs. And if the black goats mate, they will most likely produce black kids. Occasionally, white sheep would produce a spotted or speckled lamb. And of course, if spotted sheep or goats were to mate, they would more likely than others produce spotted or speckled offspring. So Jacob said, here's the deal. Let me go through the herd, and I will separate out the fewer and less valuable spotted sheep and goats, and they will be mine, along with whatever spotted and speckled lambs or kids they produce. Laban thought about it and said, okay, because Jacob would continue to do all that Jacob had been doing for 14 years and the prosperity that came to Laban because of it, and all Jacob would get in return would be the few and the less valuable spotted and speckled lambs and kids. Now, knowing something about genetics, Laban immediately, however, stacked the deck against Jacob. That very day, instead of letting Jacob go through the herd and select out the spotted and speckled and striped sheep and goats, Laban himself went through the herds, and he took all of those that were spotted or speckled, he put them in the care of his sons, and sent them 3 days' distance journey, 3 days' journey distance away, so that they could have absolutely no influence whatsoever on the herds that remain, or the flocks that remain, which are all monochromatic, all white or all black. Now, by removing all of the spotted sheep and spotted goats, Laban not only stole immediately from Jacob those that the deal was he would have, that Jacob would have, but he also, if you understand something about genetics that we've been talking about, he stole the possibility for many of those kind of sheep to be born. Jacob had been cheated for 14 years, and now he was being cheated again. Amazingly, Jacob determines to go ahead with the deal anyway. And with the disadvantage that Jacob had, it would take him many, many years to be able to gather the kind of prosperity, the kind of cattle or flocks, the wealth, to be able to support his family in leaving. So according to the story, Jacob did some animal management of his own. At the time of year that the flocks would come to mate or to breed, Jacob took some poplar branches from the poplar tree, and he peeled strips of the bark down so that the branch was left alternatingly white and darker, or lighter and darker around the branch. Then he took those striped branches, and he put them nearby the watering troughs where the flocks would come and they would mate. And thus, a greater number than normal of these white sheep and black goats would yield striped or spotted offspring. Now, how that worked, I'm going to describe a little later. Not only did Jacob make certain that they would come to breed in front of those striped poplar branches, but also knowing something about animal husbandry, he decided to make certain that the ones who mated were the strongest ones, so that the offspring would be the strongest lambs and kids who were spotted or striped, and they in turn then would be more productive. Just 6 years later, 6 years, according to Genesis chapter 30, verse 43, in this way the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks and maidservants and men servants and camels and donkeys. Wow. Talk about clever. I think we all like this kind of story. There's something in it that appeals to us. Magazines and television producers know that many of us love to hear the kinds of stories of how individuals overcome great odds and go on to great success. We love the pictures of that average, nerdy-looking Bill Gates graduation picture, because we see ourselves in that picture, and if he could do it, maybe. Who knows what the future might hold? We love hearing the story of the early single mom impoverished life of some professional football player, and then to see the pictures of the three homes he now owns and the seven automobiles. We even stand in awe of people in our own communities and even in our churches who seem to have made it. Now, we're jealous of those who just inherited, but we are in awe of those who seem to overcome great odds or who look just like us and who got there. I think we like those stories because it keeps our dreams alive. If someone that average looking and that average of a person can do it, then maybe we can too. We like it then when we read this story about Jacob. For here's this hard-working man who finally gets what is rightfully his. We like the story because that old Scrooge Laban finally gets bested. That cheat. We love the story because Jacob is smart. He's clever. We love this up-from-the-bottom kind of success story. But is this story actually about hard work and shrewdness and justice and success? Is this story just about how to get ahead in life by being cleverer than the next person? Is this a story that ought to make its way into sales manuals so that sales managers can show people how to really do it when the odds are stacked against you? If this is the only part of the story that we read, that is, if we don't look at the larger context, it does in fact look that way, that the cleverness of Jacob is what results in his great prosperity. But from the larger context, I can tell you it certainly is not about those things. But before I tell you what it is about, I'd like to remind you for whom this story was first written, for it helps us understand what the story is about. Moses authored the first five books of the Old Testament. And we know that Moses authored these books when he was leading, that is, he was the head of this 1.5 million or 2+ million people who had come out of Egypt and were heading across the desert and planning to go into Canaan and invade that land. Now, those people were certainly disadvantaged in many ways. They had no country of their own. They certainly had little in terms of assets. They were a people who certainly had reason to wonder about the future and to be concerned about it. After all, they had been marching with virtually nothing for 40 years or camping for 40 years, and they were about to invade a country that was very well fortified with tremendously good armies. Talk about an uncertain future. Circumstances were stacked against them. They had few assets with which to do what they were called on to do. Why does Moses then tell this story? He tells it because he's talking about a man who had the circumstances stacked against him, and a man who had little to bring to the whole situation, and what happened in spite of it. Moses wanted those people to learn from Jacob's experience. Don't we all wish that we could control the future, particularly our own future? Don't we, in fact, spend a lot of energy attempting to control the future? We attack our work, we attack our health, we attack even our relationships, though sometimes unconsciously, to ensure our advantage in the future. We spend a great deal of energy trying to somehow control what is going to happen. And we are greatly tempted to think that it's by our own resourcefulness, it's by our own industriousness or industry that we can overcome obstacles and we can fulfill that picture that we have of our own future. And we especially like Bible stories that seem to corroborate that whole approach to life. Those stories that suggest if you work hard enough and are smart enough and hang in there long enough, you too can make the future that you want for yourself. Is that what the story is? Is this a be-all-you-can-be story? Is this Six Steps to Success seminar? Is this some kind of a how to survive in an unfair world lesson? No, in fact, it is quite the opposite. Note these. Number one, this story is not about Jacob's prosperity, but it's about God's purposes in Jacob's life. Secondly, it is not about Jacob's clever ingenuity, but about God's gracious intervention. Thirdly, it is not about Jacob's material possessions, but it is about our spiritual responses. First of all, then, this is not a story about Jacob's prosperity, but about God's purposes. Now again, if we look at the immediate text only, we see a rags-to-riches story, but when we look at the broader context, we begin to get a different view. We begin to see that it's a different issue. Several times over the preceding history, God had promised Jacob that through Jacob, God would continue to unfold God's plan for his people in the world, and how God would work that all out. He had begun that plan with Abraham many years earlier, and we have seen it continued through Abraham's son Isaac. Then to Jacob himself, God comes revealing God's plan for Jacob and what God would do in the years ahead through him. What we see in this text included, especially in light of the context, is what we have is God unfolding God's plan very systematically to do what it was that God had in mind. Now, God's plan was that the nations of the world would be blessed through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their descendants. And what do we find in our text? Even Laban himself, along with Jacob, acknowledges that Laban's prosperity has come as a result of what? God's blessing. There you have in microcosm what God sees in the future as the great thing that will happen all over the world in this little small way. In fact, it has already begun to be played out. God's plan for Jacob was that he would be the father of the tribes, the families that would eventually become the nation of Israel. And earlier in chapter 30, we saw how that God had begun to work that out, for we saw that Jacob had 11 sons, the 12th would be born later, and one daughter. Those sons would become the heads of the 12 tribes or families of Israel. God's plan was that Jacob would inherit a land of his own and the prosperity that goes with it. And in our text, we see the beginning of that promise being fulfilled as God makes Jacob prosperous to send him back to the promised land. Jacob's deal with Laban is not just about Jacob becoming a wealthy man. This whole deal with Laban is about God working his gracious plan out in Jacob's life. Now, the story is not about Jacob's very limited view. The story is about God's perfect vision of what is going to take place in the future. Most of us would like to paint our own picture of the future. Then we would like God to bless it and guarantee it. We'd like to imagine what the future is going to be like, the way we want to shape it, and then we say, God, would you please? But are we willing to let God paint the picture? That's the picture that God says he will bless. That's the picture that God says he wants to guarantee. Now, our first reaction when we think about God painting the picture of our future is that God may include things we don't like, so we'd rather paint our own picture. But look at Jacob. If Jacob had been painting the picture of his future, when would he have left Laban? When he had absolutely nothing. He was ready at the beginning of our story, chapter 30, about verse 25, he was ready to take his large family, his great responsibility, with nothing else and head off to go to his home country. But because God painted the picture, when did he leave? Only after he was a very prosperous man. Then, in God's timing, with God's picture, God was ready to take Jacob beyond to the next step in the plan that God had for him. Whose picture do you think then Jacob thought was the best? His or God's? I hope that I have not too often spoken of the circumstances surrounding the adoption of our son Paris, but I could not help it in this context. 2 years ago, or even 6 months ago, if you had asked me to paint the picture of the future, I tell you how I would have painted it. I would have painted it with that little boy becoming the son of some family that would care for him because I knew it couldn't happen for us. 6 months later, God painted the picture. To whom does he belong? He's my son. I never could have imagined the picture being painted that way, but God painted it that way. Now ask me, whose painting do I like best? Of course. We too often fear God's plans for our lives when what the Scripture says and demonstrates over and over again is that anything else is significantly less. Any other picture is significantly less than what God has in mind for us. Whose picture of the future do you really want? You want God to paint that picture. This story is not about Jacob's prosperity. This story is about God's best plan for Jacob and how God can be trusted to bring that to pass. And God can be trusted with our futures. Secondly, the story here is not about Jacob's clever ingenuity. Oh, it's very tempting to think that, but the story is actually the opposite. It's about God's gracious intervention. When you first read the story about Jacob and Laban, we get the impression that Jacob really outwitted the old boy. He caught him in his own act. He beat him at his own tricks. The unaware would think that Jacob's shrewd business practices are what made him so prosperous. If Jacob had begun putting on seminars about how to beat the market, people would have flocked to hear him. This is a guru. This is the guy who knows how to make it happen. You'd want to hear him and his steps to success. Jacob himself could have begun to believe that he was now prosperous because he was a cut above the competition, because he was cleverer than the other guys, because he, Jacob, was willing, uniquely willing to make the sacrifices necessary to earn what he had earned. Very tempting for Jacob to begin to think that way. But what we find in the text, to the contrary, is that Jacob knew all along, and he never, ever forgot by whose hand he had gained his prosperity. Even in our story, he tells Laban, it's the Lord who has made it all happen. Later, when Jacob was talking to his own wives, it's in chapter 31, this is what he says, and he says it so forcefully we can't miss the point. The God of my father has been with me. You know, speaking to his wives, you know that I've worked for your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. God has taken away all your father's livestock and has given them to me. Jacob was apparently not deluded into thinking that he was the source of his own prosperity. He knew it was from God. You might say, doesn't Jacob have the right to be proud of his accomplishments? After all, it was Jacob who worked so hard. It was Jacob who had the good sense to breed the stronger animals. It was Jacob who shrewdly planned how to get more spotted animals. Yeah, I suppose looking at it only that way, you'd say, yes, he had a right to be proud. But Jacob understood that even all of that came from the Lord. His mind, his health, his abilities, it all came from God. Bible scholars, some of them at least, are somewhat perplexed by the part of the story where Jacob puts striped branches in front of the breeding cattle to ensure that more striped animals would be born. We know, or at least think we know, that that can't possibly work. That's not how genetics, that's not how biology works. Was this just superstition that God chose to ignore and bless Jacob in spite of the superstition? I think John Calvin comes the closest to giving us a most plausible explanation for what was occurring in this text. He suggests, based on the dream that Jacob tells us about in the next chapter, and Jacob tells his wives that it was during this time that we're talking about today, that God came to him in a dream and talked to him about the striped and spotted animals. And while Jacob does not specifically mention the striped poplar branches as the means to be used, he certainly sets up the context for us to believe that God may well have told Jacob to use those striped poplar branches. Why would God do that? Well, for very much the same reason that he told Moses many years later to make a bronze image of a snake. And when the people of Israel, because of their sin, were being bitten by a plague of snakes, what was Moses supposed to do to solve the problem? Hold up a bronze image of a snake. How ridiculous was it? Did that bronze snake cure people? Not for a second. Moses was simply holding up that bronze snake in obedience to God, and Moses and everybody there who looked in faith understood full well what that was about. It was simply representing God. And if they would look in faith to God, he would heal them. In fact, every time they looked at that snake, they recognized that nothing but the supernatural intervention of God was going to bring a cure. Likewise, every time those flocks came to those watering troughs and old Jacob had to strip that bark off and stick those things in the ground, I mean, can you imagine how the people must have hooted when they saw him doing that, as if somehow that was going to bring about the breeding or the offspring being striped and spotted every time he would stick those sticks in the ground? he would be reminded that it's nothing but the miraculous intervention of God that is doing this. Would Jacob be proud of his prosperity? No. Jacob knew that God is the one who had outlined the plan and God is the one who was painting in the picture. He knew that while God had called on him to be a part of the process, God alone was the source. God was the source. Helen Rosevere was a missionary from England to Zaire a number of years ago. And she told of delivering a child late one night, and the mother died in childbirth. Being some time ago, they did not have an incubator. And so they simply wrapped the child as best they could. They put the child as close to a fire they had made as possible. They had one of the nurses lie on the other side of the child to try to protect the child. They had wanted to use a water bottle, but the only one they had broke when they were filling it. The next day, Helen was telling the children in the orphanage about the birth and the death and the broken hot water bottle. With the usual bluntness and naive faith of a little child, a 10-year-old little girl said, "Well, let's pray and ask God to send a hot water bottle." And the little girl immediately began to pray, and then also prayed that God would send a little doll baby for the child. Well, Helen said, when the little girl finished praying, "I really didn't quite know what to do. I thought maybe I should help her understand that things don't always work out that way, and I wanted to protect the child from great disappointment." Mid-afternoon that day, Helen got a notice sent to her that a package had been delivered to her bungalow. She said, "I began to cry." She said, "I couldn't go there without taking those children with me." And so 30 pairs of eyes were glued on the box as I began to open it. She said that she pulled bright colored material from the package, and she pulled some knitted jerseys and some other things, some bandages. But she said, when I dug my hand deeply into the box near the bottom, could it be? And she pulled out a hot water bottle. She said, "I began to cry. Openly began to cry. She said, "I realized I had not asked God for that. I had not even believed that God could do it." But the little girl who had prayed rushed forward at that point in time and dug into the box and said, "Where's the doll baby?" And she found it. One brightly colored little doll. Now the important part of the story is this. That package had been packed and sent 5 months earlier. God is the source. It's God's plan that he's unfolding. God is the one who provides. Listen to the pun, please. Jacob was not a self-made man who worshiped his creator. Jacob was being a God-made man who was worshiping the creator. Lastly, this story about Jacob is not about material prosperity, but it is about the spiritual responses of humility and gratitude and stewardship. Jacob was not passive in this entire process. When you read the story, you understand that Jacob worked and he worked hard. Jacob was smart. Jacob was clever. He put the mind that God gave him to work. Jacob persevered even when it looked like nothing would ever change. He was a true steward of everything that God gave him, but he humbly recognized that every bit of it came from God. A young Olympic athlete was talking to a new friend and describing what life had been like over the preceding years, a life of discipline and along with sweat. And the friend began to ask the athlete several questions. "How did you get started in gymnastics?" "Oh, yeah, you know, my dad was a gymnast back in college, and he noticed that I was built a lot like him, and so he began to work out with me." "Isn't it expensive to train like that?" "Yeah, it really is. You know, my dad had to work an additional part-time job to pay for the gym and the gym time." "But what about a coach? I've heard you have to have just the right coach to really be competitive as an Olympic athlete." "You're right. My dad had a friend who got in touch with my coach. He's got to be the best in the world." "Well, how did you, all the years that you've been in athletics, you've also been in school. How did you handle the homework and stuff like that?" "Oh, my dad would wait at night for me and help me with my homework." "Wow, an Olympic gymnast. I'll bet you're really proud." "Yeah, I really am. I've won almost every competition I've entered." "No,
No, I meant, I'll bet you're really proud of your dad. Who's the source? God's the source. Jacob was not proud of himself. Jacob was proud of his heavenly father. Too often in our daily lives, I think we believe that life is a closed system. That all we have is ourselves and our own ingenuity and our perseverance and our abilities, and we begin to look at life like that. And we begin to think that we have to somehow make it all happen. And we paint this picture of the future with ourselves only in mind and our abilities, and then we ask God to bless it and guarantee it. When in fact, our world is not a closed system at all. But our God is intervening at every point. God intersects with his world all of the time, superintending, controlling, even positively manipulating all things. For what? For our prosperity? No, for his purposes. To fulfill the painting that he has for my life and yours. And again, in the long haul, whose painting do you think is best? Will you trust him? God will provide. Do you believe that? Do you relate to God in that way, worshiping him and thanking him? Do you pray in that way, depending on him? He can be trusted. He will provide. Let's pray.